which is a town in present-day Ukraine, and that was in 1857. The family moved to Warsaw in 1861, where Konrad's father took part in the nationalist resistance against the Russian Empire, which dominated over a significant part of Poland at the time. On account of his anti-Russian activities, Konrad's father was arrested and the whole family were briefly exiled to northeast Russia. Within only a few years, Konrad lost both his parents and was taken under the care of his wealthy uncle, Tadeusz Bobrowski, who encouraged him to fulfill a boyhood dream and become a sailor at the age of 16. Konrad joined the French merchant marine and sailed for the West Indies in 1875, but was soon disenchanted with life at sea. He incurred heavy debts and even attempted a suicide in 1878. Having recovered from this experience, Konrad enlisted in the British Merchant Navy and rose quickly through the ranks to become a master, that is, a naval officer responsible for the navigation of a ship in 1886, the same year in which he became a naturalized British subject. In 1890, Konrad was appointed captain of a steamboat by a company trading in the Belgian Congo and embarked on a journey up the Congo River from Kinshasa to Stanley Falls. Upon arriving at Stanley Falls, Konrad remembered a boyhood dream of traveling to the center of Africa, which had remained a blank spot on the European map of the world. The memory proved painfully naive, however, vis-a-vis the reality of the African interior and what Konrad describes in his essay, Geography and Some Explorers, as the distasteful knowledge of the vilest scramble for loot that ever disfigured the history of the human conscience and geographical exploration. It is precisely this discrepancy between the imaginary, on the one hand, and the reality of colonial Africa, on the other, that informs the events and the atmosphere of the novella. The importance of Heart of Darkness for this particular module is twofold. On the one hand, it is important as a modernist text characterized by stylistic experimentation, which reflects a cultural shift occurring at the end of the Victorian period and throughout the first couple of decades of the 20th century. On the other hand, it is both a direct and indirect representation of the European imperialism and its underlying assumptions, and as such, foreshadows thematically the final chapter of this module, that is, the end of colonialism and the beginning of the post-colonial period. I will illustrate both these aspects of the novella with examples of seminal research which have influenced the way we think about the text today and have shaped two major trends in Konradian criticism, especially insofar as Heart of Darkness is concerned. One, dealing with the stylistic aspects of the text, and another, focusing on its colonial, anti-colonial themes. To highlight the experimental aspect of the novel, I'll make a recourse to Ian Watt's seminal work, Konrad in the 19th Century, which explores, amongst other things, the impressionist and symbolist techniques in Heart of Darkness. Watt's discussion of the formal aspects of the novella begins with a quotation from the text, which can be seen as a brief explanation of its narrative method. This is what the anonymous primary narrator says about Marlowe, who is the secondary narrator in the story. And this is the first quotation on your handout. It's a very dense passage, so I'm going to read it out slowly. The yarns of seamen have a direct simplicity, the whole meaning of which lies within the shell of a cracked nut. But Marlowe was not typical, if his propensity to spin yarns be accepted. And to him, the meaning of an episode was not inside like a kernel, but outside, enveloping the tale which brought it out only as a glow brings out a haze, in the likeness of one of these misty halos that sometimes are made visible by the special illumination of moonshine. Okay. Now, for what the passage indicates, two distinct qualities of the narrative, which are suggested metaphorically and can be described somewhat loosely as symbolist and impressionist. the images of nut, kernel, shell, and haze and halo suggest that the meaning of the story transcends its narrative vehicle. That is, the straightforward meaning of the words on the page, which in turn gives a symbolic dimension to the narrative. However, the images of the haze and the misty halo introduce a sensory element into the meaning of the story, which makes it impressionist. Now, we're going to examine each of these elements of the narrative in turn, starting with its impressionist quality. As you know, impressionism is a term coined to describe a particular school of painting which developed in the late 19th century, first in France and then in other European countries, including Britain. Impressionists have often been accused of representing the atmospheric conditions instead of the actual subject of their paintings. Such an accusation has been met with irony by Claude Monet himself, who have reportedly said, "Poor blind idiots, they want to see everything clearly, even through the fog." For Monet and the Impressionists in general, the subject of a painting cannot be separated from the conditions under which the aesthetic perception took shape, as conditions and subject are at one in the eye of the beholder. In other words, what the Impressionists seek to represent is the visual sensations of a particular individual at a particular time and place. And if you know a lot or something about Impressionists, you would know Monet's studies of different places and different objects which he painted at different times of day. And famously, the cathedral in Rouen is one of those subjects. As Ian Watt maintains, there is a clear parallel between the type of representation created by the Impressionist technique and Marlowe's narrative strategy revealed to us by the primary narrator. The analogy between a physical world transfigured by atmospheric influences in Monet and the meaning of Heart of Darkness as a reflection in misty halos illuminated by moonshine is telling in itself. But the important thing is what stands behind these visual images. For what? This is a common tendency in both Conrad and the Impressionists to problematize the relation between individual sense impressions and meaning. Put another way, for both Conrad and the Impressionists, the exact meaning of an object of perception cannot be easily separated from the conditions in which it is perceived. The meaning of the perceived object becomes dependent on the very act of perception. A stylistic technique which illustrates best this tendency in Conrad is what Ian Watt calls delayed decoding. Delayed decoding is a device whereby the narrator describes a sense impression without explaining its meaning until later. And this is how Watt himself defines this technique. Delayed decoding combines the forward temporal progression of the mind as it receives messages from the outside world with the much slower reflexive process of making out their meaning. Through this device, the reader participates in the instantaneous sensations and is made to see what a character may not see at the moment. So, to sum up, by using delayed decoding, Conrad records the immediate sensations of the protagonist and, in this way, follows into the footsteps of the Impressionists, who represent visual sensations directly. An example of delayed decoding can be found in the second passage on your handout, which describes the attack on Marlowe's ship. "I was looking down at the sounding pole and feeling much annoyed to see at each try a little more of it stick out of that river, when I saw my poleman give up the business suddenly and stretch himself flat on the deck, without even taking the trouble to haul his pole in. He kept hold on it, though, and it trailed in the water. At the same time, the fireman, whom I could also see below me, sat down abruptly before his furnace and ducked his head. I was amazed. Then I had to look at the river mighty quick because there was a snag in the fairway. Sticks, little sticks, were flying about, thick. They were whizzing before my nose, dropping below me, striking behind me against my pilot house. All this time, the river, the shore, the woods were very quiet, perfectly quiet. I could only hear the heavy splashing thump of the stern wheel and the patter of these things. We cleared the snag clumsily. Arrows, by Jove! We were being shot at. The passage makes a perfect illustration of the concept of delayed decoding. We see Marlowe observing a set of events which defy the common logic of the situation, thereby creating a comic effect. At a moment of danger, when the ship is negotiating shallow waters, the poleman, whose responsibility it is to guarantee safe passage, seems to give up the business. The fireman follows suit. As a skipper, Marlowe would be astonished at these developments, especially as he is not able to identify a cause and effect logic behind them. His confusion grows even further when he sees an inexplicable multitude of sticks raining down on the ship. It takes a few more moments for the realization to dawn on him that these are not in fact sticks, but arrows. And this is a key realization which then recontextualizes the events he has witnessed and makes him understand the situation at hand, that is, that they're being attacked. So you see how in delayed decoding there is a temporary withdrawal of interpretation of the events witnessed by the character. The exact meaning of the scene is revealed only in retrospect after an initial sense of confusion. The example of the sudden attack against the ship foregrounds the different factors which interfere with our understanding of the world around us. In the case of Marlowe, these are his preoccupation with taking the ship across the shallows, as well as his habitual frame of reference, which makes him see sticks instead of arrows. This, in turn, demonstrates how reality can easily be distorted by individual sense perception, and that our understanding of the world is precarious and subjective. In contrast to our everyday understanding of the world as an absolute objective reality existing outside human consciousness, the delayed decoding technique reveals the world as something which is constructed, put together within the mind of the individual. Now, we'll return to this thought in a short while, but before that, we'll explore briefly the symbolist qualities of Heart of Darkness as underscored by Ian Watt. If we return to the primary narrator's description of Marlowe's narrative technique, that was the first quotation on your handout. You remember the meaning of the story is to be found outside of it. The text brings it out, the way a glow brings out a haze. For what? This image suggests an intersection of what is presumably infinite, the misty space outside the story, and the finite, the glow, which makes it visible. In this sense, the meaning of Marlowe's tale is essentially symbolic, following Thomas Carlyle's definition of the symbol as a combination of the infinite and the finite. For what? The symbols found in Heart of Darkness are not of the conventional or fixed kind, that is, symbols the meaning of which is predetermined by a particular convention. For example, the apple of discord. To the contrary, the non-literal meaning of Conrad's images is multiple and undetermined. The examples furnished by Watt include symbolic actions and objects such as the elements of the plot, a journey, a death, and a return, the characters, Kurtz, the helmsman, or the women knitting black wool at the headquarters of the trade company, the incidents, Marlowe's interview for the job, or the grove of death, the material objects, for example, the heads on the posts, the scenery, the Thames versus the Congo, the atmosphere, light versus darkness. In fact, the very title of the novella itself, Heart of Darkness, has an ambiguous and profoundly symbolic meaning. Now, during your seminars, you might want to discuss some of these symbols further and identify other symbols that reflect on the overall meaning of the story. As with the impressionist quality of the novella, its symbolism is seen by Watt as an assertion of the private individual vision. And the following is a quotation from Watt. Both the impressionist and the symbolist qualities of the text are essentially reflections of the much vaster changes which first became apparent in the Romantic period and took more urgent forms during the intellectual crisis of the late 19th century. A crisis by now most familiar to literary history in its twin manifestations of the death of God and the disappearance of the omniscient narrator, end of quote. In other words, the disappearance of the omniscient narrator foregrounds in literature the importance of the individual vision of a character, which is what we find in Conrad, and which links Conrad to writers such as Joyce and Woolf. I'm now going to move on to the second critical approach to Heart of Darkness, which bears special significance to our module. This is the post-colonial critique of the text. And I'm going to begin with Chinua Achebe's response. Achebe is a Nigerian author and critic, and his reading of Heart of Darkness, which was first given as a lecture in 1975, later republished as an article in the Massachusetts Review in 77, has been extremely influential as a seminal work presenting a non-European perspective on the novella. The article has been republished many times and it's available in many edited collections on Heart of Darkness and Conrad. The main focus of Achebe's critique is not so much the favorable or unfavorable representation of African people in Heart of Darkness, but that Africa and its people are available for what he calls discursive appropriation by the European writer. In other words, the problem with Conrad's account lies in the ethical assumptions implicit in his representations of indigenous Africa. The fact that by reducing a whole continent to a symbol of primitive and atavistic humanity, Conrad has effectively devalued and dehumanized its multiple and complex pre-colonial societies. At stake for Achebe is not merely a lack of knowledge, but a willful resistance on the part of Europeans to learn about Africa, which is a manifestation of a deep-seated psychological need of the West to set up Africa as an empty space, a place of negation, he calls it, against which Europe's own state of spiritual grace can be set out. And this is a need which can be traced back historically to the earliest encounters between Europeans and Africans. The much-debated vagueness of the language of Heart of Darkness, which was commented on by F.R. Leavis, amongst others, is for Achebe not merely a stylistic feature, but a function of this myth of Africa as an irrational and hence incomprehensible place. Also in keeping with this myth is the representation of the African people in the novella as deprived of adequate human language. Conrad compares the speech of the Africans to, quote, a violent babble of uncouth sounds, end of quote. They do not speak to each other, but exchange short grunting phrases. Achebe identifies only two instances in the entire book when Conrad allows the indigenous people to speak, and on both occasions, their speech appears distorted and grotesque. Quotation three, it's on your handout. "Catch him," he snapped with a bloodshot widening of his eyes and a flash of sharp teeth. "Catch him, give him to us. To you, eh?" I asked. what would you do with them? Eat them. The other occasion on which an African is given a voice is the pronouncement of Kurt's death. Mr. Kurt, he dead. Since eloquence is traditionally associated with intelligence and is seen as a mark of civilized society, the lack of it can only be ascribed to primitive humanity and would confirm the idea of Africa as the antipode of a sophisticated rational Europe. Now, Achebe is aware that the narrative structure of Heart of Darkness is complex and its meaning is far from straightforward. The actual events of the story are refracted through two narrative lenses as it features a primary and a secondary narrator. On the one hand, there is Marlowe, the eyewitness, and then there's the anonymous second narrator who relays Marlowe's story to the reader. However, Achebe does not see a clearly manifested critical distance between Marlowe's beliefs and the values endorsed by the narrative as a whole. On the contrary, the close parallels between the life paths of Marlowe and Conrad, both seafarers and adventurers who visited the Congo, leads him to conclude that Conrad is largely sympathetic to Marlowe and, overall, subscribes to his opinions. After all, Marlowe is portrayed as a likable character who's rather appropriately appalled by the inhumane treatment of the native Congolese at the hands of their European colonizers. As such, Marlowe becomes a purveyor of values that are deeply entrenched in the 19th century liberal tradition with which Conrad identifies. The following passage can be seen as an example of these liberal values, quotation 4. They were dying slowly, it was very clear. They were not enemies, they were not criminals, they were nothing earthly now, nothing but black shadows of disease and starvation lying confusedly in the greenish gloom, brought from all the recesses of the coast in all the legality of time contracts, lost in uncongenial surroundings, fed on unfamiliar food, they sickened, became inefficient, and were then allowed to crawl away and rest. However, despite the apparent humanitarian sentiment of such passages, Achebe believes they distract the reader's attention and obscure the much more important fact of a profound inequality between Europeans and Africans on which the whole narrative is based. This inequality is best exemplified by the anxiety which the idea of a common humanity between whites and blacks evokes in Marlowe. There is a rather long passage in Achebe's article, which I've quoted only in part on your handout, which is excerpt 5, which, according to Achebe, provides incontestable proof of the European rejection of common humanity, of equality between whites and blacks. The earth seemed unearthly. We were accustomed to look upon the shackled form of a conquered monster. But there you could look at a thing monstrous and free. It was unearthly, and then men were, no, they were not inhuman. Well, you know, that was the worst of it. This suspicion of their not being inhuman, it would come slowly to one. They howled and leaped and spun and made horrid faces. But what thrilled you was just the thought of their humanity like yours. The thought of your remote kinship with this wild and passionate uproar. Ugly. Yes, it was ugly enough, but if you were man enough, you would admit to yourself that there was in you just the faintest trace of a response to the terrible frankness of that noise. A dim suspicion of there being a meaning in it which you so remote from the night of first ages, could comprehend. The sentiment expressed in this passage, the emotional disturbance felt by the white protagonist at the thought of kinship with the indigenous African, leads Achebe to conclude, and this is a quotation, that Joseph Conrad was a thoroughgoing racist. A simple truth that is glossed over in criticism of his work due to the fact that white racism against Africa is such a normal way of thinking that its manifestations go completely unremarked. He goes on to ask the question whether a work of art such as Heart of Darkness which dehumanizes Africa and its people, can continue to be regarded as a literary masterpiece and be taught at universities across the world? And this is a question that you might like to explore again in the seminar discussions. Achebe's answer is no, Heart of Darkness cannot continue to be considered a canonical text because of its implicit racism. His critique has caused a flurry of critical responses, some of which seeking to exonerate, at least in part, Conrad, of the charges brought against him. Amongst these, I will have a close look at Ian Watt's response and that of our very own Benita Parry, who's now retired, but still Professor Emerita at Warwick University. In his article, Conrad's Heart of Darkness and the Critics, Ian Watt focuses in particular on Conrad's attitudes to racism and colonialism and seeks to arrive at a more nuanced understanding of the text. As Watt points out, prior to Achebe's reading of the novella in 1975, it has usually been interpreted as an attack on the colonial practices in the Belgian Congo, and as such, as largely a progressive text. Watt begins his analysis with a definition of the word racism as a doctrine, avowed or not, that finds racial differences in character, intelligence, etc., and that asserts the superiority of one race over another or others. Watt discovers numerous examples of this attitude in the narrative, but for him, these are predominantly associated with lesser characters rather than the protagonist Marlowe. When it comes to Marlowe, Watt believes the racial perspective changes as the protagonist is capable of discriminating between different kinds of Africans. For example, those living on the banks of the river and those he works with or encounters on a daily basis. Although Marlowe displays little sympathy for the denizens of the forest, Watt sees his attitude to the blacks who surround him as a lot more nuanced. For example, Marlowe perceives the Africans paddling on one of the boats near the shore in positive terms, as a great comfort to look at. However, even in this example, the actual terms of Marlowe's description are quite unpalatable at times, and this is something Watt himself acknowledges. I've given you a quotation of this passage on the handout so that you can decide for yourselves. It's quotation number 6. Now and then, a boat from the shore gave one a momentary contact with reality. It was paddled by black fellows. You could see from afar the white of their eyeballs glistening. They shouted, sang, their bodies streamed with perspiration. They had faces like grotesque masks, these chaps. But they had bone, muscle, a wild vitality, an intense energy of movement that was as natural and true as the surf along their coast. They wanted no excuse for being there. They were a great comfort to look at. Now, Watt's interpretation of this passage is the following, and I quote, "We may perhaps find some racist assumption in their faces being described as like grotesque masks, but there is no doubt that Marlowe finds them a comfort compared to the white people aboard his ship." It seems to me that Watt is making too big of a concession here and is in danger of undermining his own claim that Marlowe's sentiments can sometimes be devoid of racist connotations. As the passage does little to assure the contemporary reader that Marlowe is capable of unproblematic understanding of racial otherness. Another example of Marlowe's favorable treatment of the Africans, favorable, that's according to Ian Watt, is the protagonist's ruminations over their cannibalistic nature and the homage he pays to them regardless. That's the final quotation on your handout. "Fine fellows, cannibals in their place. They were men one could work with. And I'm grateful to them. And after all, they did not eat each other before my face. They had brought along a provision of hippo meat, which went rotten and made the mystery of the wilderness stink in my nostrils. So in order to justify that this is indeed a favorable portrayal of the indigenous crew, Watt needs to make another concession. And this is what he says. One may find the comic irony of the last sentence in bad taste, as well as wrong in its assumption that the crew would eat each other, but Marlowe's admiration and gratitude are surely genuine. Well, there seems to be too many ifs and buts in this reading, which finds it necessary to gloss over any potentially contentious material in order to prove a point. This comes very close to selective reading, which is not generally considered a good critical practice, as it limits the validity of the author's claims and leaves room for counterarguments. Watt's final thoughts on Marlowe's, and hence Conrad's potentially racist attitudes, is equally inconclusive. He says, Marlowe and Conrad then are not fairly to be considered racists, although they are not in theory wholly opposed to the doctrine. Now, if we just stop for a minute and just think about that particular conclusion, it sounds very paradoxical in itself. Marlowe and Conrad then are not fairly to be considered racists, although they're not in theory wholly opposed to the doctrine. Now, if you go back and reread Ian Watt's own definition of racism, racist is somebody who avows, openly or not, the doctrine of superiority of one race over another. It seems to me that the definition of racism is also accounting for implicit racism, which is what this particular conclusion seems to be getting at, that there is implicit racism in Marlowe and Conrad. However, this does not make them racist. Now, such a conclusion makes one rather uneasy, I think, as it remains unclear what degree of non-opposition to the doctrine of racism would actually make one a racist. Somehow, in trying to acquit Marlowe, and by extension Conrad, of Achebe's charge, Watt has arrived at an essentially self-contradictory claim that does little to disperse the doubts of the reader. However, Watt is right that Heart of Darkness presents a complex and nuanced account of European colonialism in Africa. And this is persuasively argued in Benita Perry's analysis of the text. I will only briefly mention here Perry's examination of Curtis' portrayal as an illustration of a profound paradox around which the narrative is structured. So for Perry, the different nuances in Conrad's attitude towards imperialism in racism are implicit in a narrative paradox. And Kurtz, as a symbol in the text, exemplifies this narrative paradox. In the story, Kurtz is the personification of Western imperialism, which is gradually revealed as monstrous and predatory. Symbolically significant in this respect is what Perry calls Kurtz's voracious appetite for possession, evident in his insistent claim of ownership. My intended, my ivory, my station, my river, my, everything belonged to him. This is what Marlowe explains. Conrad's denouncement of this imperial attitude is evident throughout the story and needs little further corroboration. However, there is a complicating twist in that the catalyst, so in this sense, Conrad, by attacking this attitude, Conrad emerges as an anti-colonialist. he seems to be attacking what Kurtz stands for, that is, colonial discourse, the civilizing mission of the West in Africa, as intrinsically corrupt. So that would justify an interpretation that Conrad's text is, in fact, anti-imperialist, not racist in any way. However, things are a bit more complex, and Parry finds a twist here. The twist is that the catalyst which seems to bring out the worst in Kurtz is the African wilderness and its inhabitants. How many powers of darkness called Kurtz for their own? The wilderness had found him out and had taken on him a terrible vengeance for the fantastic invasion. I think it had whispered to him, Marlowe says, things about himself which he did not know, till he took counsel with this great solitude. It echoed loudly within him because he was hollow at the core. When Marlowe tries to fight for Kurtz's soul, he runs up against what he calls the spell of the wilderness. I tried to break the spell, the heavy, mute spell of the wilderness that seemed to draw him to its pitiless breast by the awakening of forgotten and brutal instincts, by the memory of gratified and monstrous passions. This alone had beguiled his unlawful soul beyond the bounds of permitted aspirations. Now, it's the problem of this representation of the African landscape is that it is essentially a Eurocentric projection. Remember, Achebe talked about Africa as a symbol of a primitive humanity, of an atavistic humanity. Clearly, this is a representation from a European point of view. So it is a European projection, a figment of the European imagination, which has transformed a geographical locus, Africa, into a quasi-mythical repository of evil, cruelty, and violence. And what is more, it is precisely such phantasmagorical representations of Africa that justified and legitimized Western claims for a civilizing mission in supposedly barbaric places. In other words, Conrad's narrative denounces the colonial practices in the Belgian Congo. But the very terms of this critique are steeped in the ideology which was used to justify colonialism. The main difference between Parry and Watt's response to Achebe is that Parry focuses on the profoundly paradoxical nature of the novella and engages critically with it, whereas Watt seems more concerned with explaining away the inconsistencies in the text, which at times makes his very own account inconsistent and self-contradictory. And this is an advice to all of you who would like to write an essay on Conrad. Don't try and iron out the inconsistencies, the paradoxes, the contradictions. They're there to be critically engaged with, and it tells you more about the meaning of the story. Thank you.